Hello, and welcome back to Responsa Radio, where you ask and we answer questions of Jewish law in modern times. I'm here once again with Rabbi Ethan Tucker, Rosh Yeshiva at Machon Hadar, a center for higher Jewish learning based in New York City.
Hi, Avi. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Great to be here.
We've got some great questions. So we've had a question in the past about when our halachic practice and specifically Shabbat practice interacts or intersects with a career choice or a career path. And this question, I think, fits into that same category. The questioner writes, it's well known that taking care of one's own pets, i.e. feeding them, is permissible on Shabbat. I'm a graduate student in insect biology. For my research, I frequently have insects in my care during studies. Assuming there's no chance of violating Shabbat in transit to the lab, is it permissible for me to take care of these animals on Shabbat? This might include feeding them and handling them. They're not my personal pets like a cat, but they are most certainly in my care, and I am responsible for their well-being. Does it matter if this is related to my job? And she ends with, are these insects muktzah?
All right, this is a great question with a lot of different components. Let's maybe start off just talking about animals for a minute. right, animals have always been a kind of intersecting part of human life. And when the Torah actually talks about the creation of the world, right at the beginning in its description of what happens on the sixth day, we already have the categories of behema and chaya, the domesticated animals, behemoth, that live with people, and chaya, the wild animals that are sort of part of the raw landscape of nature. And there's a sense there that part of what it's going to mean to be a human is to be living in proximity to and in distance from various kinds of animals. Now, how does that interact with Shabbat? Well, you have this basic concept, which is really an ancient, deep time concept with respect to Shabbat, which is the notion of things that we're not really prepared in advance of Shabbat in a way that you are not entering into the pristine bubble of that 25-hour Shabbat space with them in hand. One commentator on this, I think, beautifully puts it that the act of beginning Shabbat is like entering into a room from a hallway, a corridor outside. And the beginning of Shabbat represents the shutting of the door. And you only have access on Shabbat to the things that were already in that room when you come in. So with animals, right, this is actually often how it breaks down. Animals are assumed kind of by default to be eino min hamukhan or muktzeh, set aside, not prepared, part of the natural raw world that we don't really tamper with or interact with on Shabbat. And so the same way in traditional rabbinic law, you don't pick up a rock or a stick that you find outside on Shabbat, even just to pick it up, because that's part of God's world that you leave alone. You also don't pick up animals on Shabbat. They are part of the world that functions on its own schedule. And the things that you pick up are things that have been really domesticated, not a stick, but a piece of wood that's been carved into a salad server. Not just a piece of rock that's lying around, but perhaps something that's been fashioned and polished into a paperweight. The question then is, what kinds of animals do we then kind of interact with and are considered enough a part of our sphere of influence that we can deal with them in one way or the other? So this is actually a very old question. The Mishnah deals with this already in Masechet Shabbat, and it talks there about a ban on placing water in front of bees or in front of doves that fly into a dovecot, which was kind of their version of a birdhouse that you would have in your backyard. And the sense there is that these animals are different from other animals mentioned in the Mishnah, like geese and chickens, which one is permitted, in fact, to put water in front of on Shabbat. Now, what's the exact dividing line there? So in the Talmud, Rav Ashi seems to boil this down to a difference between animals that are in the category of mizonotehen alayich, you are responsible to feed them, and ein mizonotehen alayich, you are not responsible to feed them. So the bees and these doves that kind of fly in, they're not really counting on you for food, and therefore you don't spend your Shabbat time actually getting stuff for them, even something as innocuous as water. Whereas the chickens and geese that are in your house and are basically your backyard animals, they're depending on you for water. And therefore, not only is it appropriate for you to give them that stuff, you're actually expected to do it. So this is where I think we get into the practical application question. There's some dispute as to how to read the bottom line conclusion in the Talmud, because in addition to the distinction I just mentioned, the Talmud also says water is also particularly problematic to put in front of bees, because there's presumably a lot of water in some marshland that's not so far off that they could easily access themselves, which at least opens us up to a possible reading of the Talmud that you can feed animals if one of two conditions applies. Either those animals are your responsibility, in your care, as the questioner puts it. And potentially also, even if they're not, if there is something that you have that this animal can't really access on its own, and by feeding it, you would provide it with that, that's also legitimate on Shabbat. And one later commentator quite beautifully puts that as a fulfillment of the almost mythic injunction that we emulate God in a certain way when we feed animals, even wild animals, because we have the experience of having care and compassion for one of God's creatures, and that is part of what God wants. So laying out that framework, you then actually get a question I was really interested as I was looking into this to discover this, very similar to what the questioner asks about. Rav Hai Gaon, one of the great Babylonian authorities in the 10th and 11th century, addresses a case of someone who keeps silkworms and needs them clearly for the production of silk and other things they're going to do with them beyond Shabbat, but they need to feed them. They can't starve them all day. And Rav Hai Gaon says, silkworms are clearly in the category of something that mizonotehen alaich. You are responsible for them and must feed them, and therefore you're allowed to do it. And on some level, I would actually say that precedent, which is then cited in later literature, is the direct answer to the question, which is, if she's responsible for the ants have no other way of getting food and they need to be fed, for sure she can feed them on Shabbat.
So it turns out Shabbat and insect biology have been intersecting for many years.
It turns out. This is not the first person to ask it. I wanted to throw in another dimension here, even though I think that's a sufficient answer. There's another dimension here, which I think is actually important. There's a practice, I don't know if you had this in your family, Avi, but I did growing up, on Shabbat Shira, on the Shabbat of Bishalach, when we read the Song of the Sea, Shirat Hayam, there was a practice in many European Jewish communities, my grandmother always did this, to put out bread for the birds on that Shabbat morning. You get up on the morning of Shabbat Shira, and it's a little hard when you're in an apartment in New York City, but you find some place where you feed the birds on that morning. And it's connected to a kind of agadic, mythic memory of the birds also having sung the song at the sea, and there being this gratitude to them for participating in that incredible moment of Jewish history and wanting to pay them back on that morning when we read it with this act of kindness. And all kinds of people attack this practice, rabbis, because they say, how can you feed wild birds on Shabbat, right? Even not so wild, these birds that kind of come into your birdhouse that the Mishnah talks about, you're not allowed to put water in front of them. You're seemingly not allowed to put bread in front of them. So the Aruch HaShulchan, the great late 19th, early 20th century rabbinic codifier, offers two ways to think about this and why the practice is legitimate. One is, he says, we're not really feeding them to take care of them in the context of that practice. We're feeding them in order to do something for ourselves, which is namely to kind of show our overwhelming feeling of gratitude. And therefore, for that, it's legitimate to do it because on some level, we're caring for ourselves, not for the birds.
It seems like somewhat of an unfortunate methodology.
Yeah, say more.
It's, you know, you just took this beautiful custom of giving back to the birds to acknowledge their role and made it actually about us.
Yeah, I hear you. I think I took him, but I have to go back and see it, to be saying that the act that we're trying to do there in some kind of gratitude to them is actually some kind of deep religious act that has significance other than just sort of a pedestrian act of making sure a bird's not hungry. But truth be told, what you're saying actually leads into the second reason that he raises, which is that this is for a mitzvah. That is to say, it's for an act of religious significance. And that perhaps in those contexts, it's warranted to feed even wild animals. And I thought of that in the context of this question because obviously there's some element of this person is pursuing this research for their own advancement, their own learning, their own degree that they're acquiring. And according to the Aruch HaShulchan's first reason, that may very much resonate. But to the extent also that the research that's being engaged here will ultimately redound to the benefit of humanity and to improve human living, that surely qualifies as a mitzvah in this category and makes sense that we would also be lenient in terms of feeding these animals, even if we didn't have the silkworm precedent. I think that in addition to all those factors, her question about, you know, are the animals mukta? Are these things that you shouldn't pick up? So in general, our approach, even with domesticated animals, and truth be told, even with pets, as a matter of black letter law, one is not supposed to pick up an animal on Shabbat. The discussions are quite complex around someone who has a pet dog or a pet cat, can they pick them up on Shabbat? Now, anyone who actually has a dog or a cat, as far as I'm aware, picks them up on Shabbat. And the question is, how do we think through that? And that's beyond the scope of what we'll get into here. But suffice it to say, as the pet culture among Jews has grown, there have been attempts to revive certain earlier medieval precedents that might see there as almost being three categories of animals, if you will. The truly wild ones, the ones that are domesticated but kind of live in the backyard, and then the ones that are almost extensions of ourselves to the point where they become no longer mukta because we've so domesticated them that they're so obviously in that room, if you will, for Shabbat before we've closed the door.
I'll just add that on Shabbat Shira of this year, we will both be at the Yeshivat Hadar Alumni Shabbaton. So hopefully we and maybe many of our listeners will have a chance to actually engage in this practice together.
Great. Well, we'll have a big feeding together. That'll be fun. I wonder how the hotel will like it.
Before we start this next question, I want to share with our listeners a new way of learning with Machon Hadar. Project Zug, powered by Machon Hadar, is an online learning platform that provides dynamic content and a Chavruta learning partner in America, Israel, or around the world. You can view the new courses and register at www.projectzug.org. So here's the question. Why do some rabbinic authorities allow a single dishwasher to be used for both meat and dairy dishes at different times, while others do not? And this person adds, what's the correct answer?
That's a great one. So I want to actually start this off with a story that I think will help people understand what's going on. One of my dear friends from college was roommates or hallmates, I think, with a kind of well-intentioned, curious, non-religious guy. And one of the things that this friend of mine, who was an observant Jew, was explaining to him was that how the laws of kashrut meant that you needed to look for all kinds of certifications on different products to make sure that you could use them. And he, you know, pulled out some kind of jar of food and pointed out an OU on it to him and said, you know, this is the kind of thing that you look for. And, you know, the guy sort of nodded and was like, oh, that's very interesting. About a week later, the guy bursts into his college dorm room holding a box of Tide and says, "You people eat detergent?" pointing to the OU that's on the box. That story, obviously very amusing, has at its heart the answer to this question, which is the presence of that OU on that box obviously reflects some notion, or at least some strand of the tradition, that even something that has been kind of dramatically altered from its initial form as food might be a problem. In the case of detergent, maybe animal products of some form that were used in that detergent would then get on your tablecloth, your napkins, etc., and you wouldn't want them near your food. So let's try to actually step back and answer the question and maybe explain the slightly odd appearance of Hechscher's on laundry detergent. So there's a line in the Shulchan Aruch where the Shulchan Aruch is talking about meat and milk dishes and them getting mixed together. And he says, it seems to me that if you had a case where they put ashes, and here he means ashes in the sense of soap, the basic way that soap was produced in late Middle Ages and in early modernity, the substance we know as alkali. If you had ashes, this sort of soap material, in hot water, and then you put milk and meat covered dishes into that kind of an environment, everything would remain permitted because the soap would neutralize the food and make it incapable of creating a problem. So even though you've got milk and meat and hot water all in the same container, which is usually a recipe for a kashrut disaster, the Shulchan Aruch says, it seems to me if there's soap in there, then you've got no problem. All right, so it would seem from that we would be home free in all kinds of circumstances. But it's actually not totally clear the parameters of what he's saying. So there actually are four approaches that emerge from responding to the Shulchan Aruch. One of them is the approach of some of the early Ashkenazi commentators, the Shach and the Taz, who completely reject this ruling. Actually, really interestingly, they just say, no, this is unprecedented. There's no source for this. Soap doesn't do anything. If there's milk and meat there together, certainly if there's something treif in there, the soap can't just undo that. And it's actually fidelity to some of those voices that leads to things like an OU on laundry detergent even today, or dishwashing soap, where in times past where things like that would have been made with tallow and other things from forbidden animals, you needed, according to those views, to verify that that stuff wasn't in there before you actually put it on your dishes. So that's approach one. That would lead to very little flexibility around dishwashers and switching back and forth between milk and meat, at least from this angle. There's another view, which is that cited in the Pitrei Tshuva, one of the collections of different responsa on the Shulchan Aruch, which takes this point a little more moderately and says, well, maybe soap does neutralize stuff, but maybe it only neutralizes stuff that on its own is fundamentally innocuous, like milk or meat, each of which on their own are permitted. And so the Shulchan Aruch says everything would be fine here because all you prevented happening was two permitted substances kind of forming some kind of amalgam that's forbidden. And the soap can kind of deny them their individual identities enough to prevent that from happening. But the Shulchan Aruch would never think that you can just sort of pour soap all over a dish that was covered with bacon and thereby soak it in hot water with something else and make it come out okay. That's approach two. Approach three says, no. When we say that soap neutralizes, it neutralizes everything it comes into contact with. Even pieces of treif will lose their identity.
And just to be clear, when we say neutralizes, it does that through changing the taste for the worse?
Exactly. Okay. The principle of notein ta'am lifgam, it will render it disgusting and to the point where it essentially becomes unedible or highly undesirable. And then it's as if it doesn't have the status of its former state.
So it's like the food becomes not really food anymore.
That's exactly right, great, according to those views. So this third view says that could work for anything. But it draws the line on saying that this will neutralize the status of an actual object, like a dish or silverware or a pot, which have been used for meat or for milk or for non-kosher food in the past. You can't just say, well, if I soak that in hot water with soap, that will effectively undo its identity. But then there is a fourth view. This is a view that's adopted by figures like Rav Yosef Kovo, a not as well-known Acharon, but also Ateret Paz, who is one of the students of the late Rav Ovadia Yosef, a contemporary, who actually hold, no, the power of soap is across the board. And to the extent that you soak a utensil in hot water and it's absorbing some of that hot water, if that hot water is infused with soap, that will essentially neutralize the identity of the utensil as well. Now, they still think you have to kosher stuff. They don't think that you can just go around washing everything in a dishwasher, because there's something that's powerful about the kind of reversal of identity purging ritual that boiling something in water or exposing it to direct flame does, that soaking with soap doesn't. But as far as the utensil's ability to actually affect other stuff that you later use it for, according to this fourth view, anything essentially that's ever been run through a dishwasher has no identity in terms of really forbidding food. So if you look at those four different approaches, you can actually see, going back to the questioner's query here, why people divide into different camps as to what they'll allow with a dishwasher. Someone who's a hardcore proponent of view one of the Shach and the Taz doesn't think that soap really has a neutralizing power. And therefore, they'll say, well, to the extent you wash dairy food in there one time and there was hot water and it got absorbed into the walls of the dishwasher, that's something you have to deal with later on when you switch over to using it for meat. And therefore, unless you kosher the dishwasher in the intervening cycle, there's no way to really allow it. Whereas the last view, which seems to have been adopted by Rav Ovadia Yosef in his later years, would actually permit for washing milk and meat in the same dishwasher at the same time, as long as there was soap present to essentially negate everything. And so then I think you can imagine how the other positions would sort of take some intermediate modes. If you wanted my kind of bottom line practical guidance that I'll give people, particularly if they don't have some kind of existing family practice on this front, I would pretty much say, in any situation of a dishwasher mess up, you probably don't have to worry about anything really having gone horribly wrong. It probably makes some degree of sense to at least wait between milk and meat cycles, perhaps only do one on one day and another more than 24 hours later in order to put some distance between the two. But I wouldn't really look askance at someone who would follow Rav Ovadia Yosef's counsel either and essentially just say the soap is a comprehensively neutralizing factor.
I heard somewhere once that the Israeli poskim tended to be more flexible with dishwashers and American poskim were more strict. Is that something that you found or heard?
Well, what's definitely true is that some of the breakdown of these positions breaks down a little bit on the Ashkenazi-Sephardi divide. That is to say, it's Rav Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch who articulates the lenient position, and it's his Ashkenazi early commentators like the Shach and the Taz that are hardcore against. And though there's a lot of movement within the Ashkenazi and Sfaradi worlds away from those respective positions, they kind of anchor it more or less along that axis. And given that Israel has so much more of a dominant culture of Sfaradi practice, that's one of the major things that does account for that.
Well, it certainly helps also.
Yeah. And I think, look, on that front, there's another thumb on the scale here, which is that it doesn't seem like keeping kosher and taking advantage of this basic life appliance ought to require having a kitchen set up with two major dishwashers and two entire separate sections, which obviously is in vogue in a lot of communities now. But, you know, the principal Torah actually cares about the financial well-being of Jews as a component of when they're keeping the mitzvot. That has to come into effect here. And I think, look, the other piece, which is a much broader conversation than dishwashers, is how do we think about the effect of the materials revolution on so much of what we use in our kitchen? Stainless steel. You now have some Israeli rabbis who are saying stainless steel is non-porous. You don't even have to kosher it. You can use it for milk and meat. Right? It's great stuff. One of my teachers described that as too lenient for the community to actually abide. But you've got, you've got Pyrex and Duralex and all these various materials now. And, you know, when you're talking about something like a stainless steel dishwasher, there's certainly a plausible argument to be made that the dishwasher never takes on any kind of identity because it's simply made of this non-porous material that, quite frankly, always looks brand new.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away.
Do you have a halachic question you would like answered on the show? Email us at halacha@machonhadar.org. H-A-L-A-K-H-A-H at machonhadar.org. You can also leave a phone message at 215-297-4254. So we have another question about Shabbat. This one perhaps has a broader appeal than the previous one. Can one ride on a free train or trolley on Shabbat? It's a question that's probably come up for many people in different cities in different ways in different capacities. So curious to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, this I think is a very live one. Let's begin with there is one precedent or potential precedent in the Shulchan Aruch about this. The Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, addresses the case of riding in a horse-drawn carriage on Shabbat, and he forbids doing so. Even if there's a non-Jewish driver, and even if the passengers are not Jewish, and you've essentially just found a way to catch a ride, it's not allowed to do that. Then he proceeds and says, the reason you're not allowed to do it is because you are using the animal that is driving the carriage on Shabbat. Of course, one of the core things of Shabbat in the Torah is that your animals must also rest and not be working on your account. And also invoking a Talmudic discussion as to why it's forbidden to ride an animal at all on Shabbat, he says you might, or the driver on your account, be tempted to grab a branch off of a passing tree in order to use it as a switch in order to beat the animal to potentially go faster. Okay, now this is actually a great example where you've got a ruling and then reasons attached to the ruling. And the question is going to be, is the ruling really a bottom line holding here? But we give some reasons to accompany it, but they're not really what it's about. Or no, are the reasons given actually the basis for this ruling, such that if they don't apply, the ruling might in fact be modified? Enter the case of public transportation that is not driven by an animal, where you've got something that is moving quickly over long distances from place to place. But seemingly, the two concerns that the Ramah raises here, which is that you're using an animal, or you might, in order to goad the animal forward, perform another forbidden Shabbat violation, those don't apply. And quite predictably, there's a split among later interpreters as to how to understand this. And I want to just lay out that practical split and then maybe reflect on what's actually going on behind that debate. So you have the Chatam Sofer, the great 19th century Hungarian rabbi, who forbids going on a steam engine, right? He already has, he doesn't quite have subways, but he's got the same basic technology. And he says you're not allowed. And how does he explain this? Because it's not a problem of an animal and it's not a problem of ripping something off. He says something that at first sounds very forced, but I think is getting at something very deep. He says, when you go on a train, your body is constantly jostling up and down, and you can't fulfill with your body the command to be at rest on Shabbat.
Fascinating.
Right? So at first you're like, oh, come on. That's just a way of, you know, forbidding something that, you know, you didn't like and you have no source for it. But essentially, I'll tell you what I think the Chatam Sofer is saying, and we'll come back to how this makes a lot of sense. The Chatam Sofer, I think, is saying the train goes too fast. It's simply too fast an object to be on during a day of rest.
You're not at rest.
Yeah, you're not at rest in the most basic elemental sense. He also talks about how it'll take you away from home and you won't have your normal Shabbat routine. But there's something deep there which I want to come back to, where he essentially says the Ramah may have given these reasons about an animal being involved, but that's not really what it's about. And in fact, if we trace all the way back to the Mishnah's ban on riding on a horse, right? I think he on some level would say at the heart of that lies a sense that you don't ride on something that goes fast on Shabbat and that takes you to other places, quite even apart from the question of whether an animal is also being made to work. So that's one approach. Rav Uziel, former chief rabbi of Israel in the 20th century, challenges the Chatam Sofer, and he takes the Ramah's reasoning very seriously. And he says, look, if you're dealing with a train or a subway or something like that, as long as it's not going, you know, outside of the Shabbat boundary, or you're not carrying things in a forbidden fashion, and as long as the operators are Gentiles and it's being done for a majority Gentile population, and nothing about the activity is being altered in any way because of you, and you can buy a ticket beforehand and all of that, Rav Uziel says, I don't see any reason why this would really be forbidden. In deference to the Chatam Sofer and to others who forbade it, he says, I think you should only allow this for something that has some positive religious force, like, he says, to go to shul, someone who lives too far from the synagogue, and they could get there on public transportation without violating anything around Shabbat. He says that should be totally permissible. All right. And again, that's really making the reasons that the Ramah gives essential and going back and saying, yeah, when the Mishnah talked about not riding on a horse, that's because either it's a Jew doing it or because we are really only concerned about these ancillary issues. And it's not the issue itself of the riding and moving quickly. I actually think what's beautifully encapsulated in this debate is a much deeper debate about Shabbat, which runs through so many details and subsections of this area of law, which is, what are we trying to do on Shabbat? Are we trying to forbid and control certain kinds of actions? Or are we trying to create some kind of atmosphere? Rav Uziel essentially follows a action-oriented paradigm when thinking about this and says, I don't know, you're not really doing anything. And no Gentiles are really doing it for you. And there's no concern that you'll come to do something else that's forbidden. Therefore, why should I forbid it? And in some ways, that way of thinking about Shabbat, I think, is actually very intuitive to many of us who live in urban environments where we have no imagined reality of a complete and totalizing Shabbat atmosphere. You live in Manhattan on Shabbat. The world is going on. Olam kaminago noheg. You're not going to stop anything about the nonstop commerce of that city. What you can control is what you do and don't do. The Chatam Sofer, I think, is pointing us to something very different, which is perhaps part of what we're trying to do, even if it's in a limited way on Shabbat, is to say that we've got a certain environment we want to be in. And part of that environment is, even if I'm not doing something physically manipulative to the physical world, is you don't go that fast on Shabbat. You don't get on stuff that speeds around from one place to another. I would say, by the way, this is the way you should understand debates over bicycles and rollerblades and all these kinds of issues that come up. People who have a resistance to people rollerblading on Shabbat, they can try, but they won't succeed in grounding it in it being a milacha or some significant action that's problematic. What they're really saying is, that thing's too fast, right? And the sense in which there are people who they would never dream of riding a bicycle, but they have no problem with their kid riding a tricycle, makes perfect sense in that frame, because a tricycle doesn't go fast and doesn't go anywhere significant.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last, just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
This next question is another food question, only this time it's not a kashrut question. It's a question about blessings before and after eating, specifically after. And the question revolves around the history of the fact that meals used to be really based around bread. It seems that people used to eat bread with every single meal, and that's not the case so much anymore. For some people, that may not be the case at all. And I think it's out of that cultural shift that this question comes. So the questioner writes, should people be able to, maybe even be obligated to bench, to say the Birkat HaMazon, the blessing of thanks after a meal, when they eat a full meal without any bread involved? In other words, should bread still be the determinative factor of what is a meal in this day and age?
Yeah, this is really becoming more and more of a question. I feel like I get this more and more from individuals all the time as various eating habits change. Why do we say the grace after meals in the first place, right? This is really the question. Rabbinic sources anchor it back in the verse in the Torah, which we say as part of the Birkat HaMazon. You'll eat, you'll have had your fill, and then you should bless God for the land that you were given. Now, in early rabbinic sources, it was not sorted out entirely what is it that you eat that triggers what kind of blessing afterwards, and particularly the full-blown, serious blessing of Birkat HaMazon, which was originally three blessings, and now in our version is four. And you had some of the early sages in the Mishnah actually debate this. So you've got Rabban Gamliel going up against a majority who seemed to be opposed to him, saying that actually, even if you eat figs and grapes and pomegranates, those should count as triggering this. And there he's certainly referring back to the verse two prior, where the land is described as Eretz Chita u'Seora, Gefen Te'ina v'Rimon, Eretz Zeit Shemen u'Dvash. The various things that the land is praised with are not just wheat and barley-based products, but also these various fruits. But nonetheless, the Chachamim here in the Mishnah seem to say, yeah, that's very nice that they're mentioned there, but that doesn't make a meal. And in fact, as a reality for what meals were back then, I think it's something like 80% of the calories that people consumed in the Middle East in the time of rabbinic sources came from grain and bread, right? So just in terms of understanding what they ate.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. It was, I don't know how good it was for the digestive system, but let's remember they were not eating our kind of pure white flour all the time. But nonetheless, bread was basically what you ate. There was no such thing as a meal without bread. Reminds me of one of my college roommates who used to eat meat at every meal and just would say, it's not a meal if I don't eat meat. Otherwise, it's a snack. So that was like bread for them. And the Chachamim seemed to toe that line. Along comes Rabbi Akiva, and he says something interesting. He says, if the person ate even a stewed vegetable, but that was their meal, then they actually say the full Birkat HaMazon. The Talmud clarifies that this is a specific minority view of Rabbi Akiva, and that the Chachamim, the majority, would have disagreed with him and essentially renders it as non-normative. And more or less what that seems to mean is that, yeah, there was this view that maybe you say Birkat HaMazon over things other than bread. It was considered and it was shot down. So it may then be surprising to hear that Rav Yoel bin Nun, who is one of the contemporary prominent religious Zionist rabbis in Israel, actually rules and practices himself that you are supposed to say Birkat HaMazon after every meal. And a question that's asked to him about this Mishnah is, well, how do you, aren't you just ruling like Rabbi Akiva and subverting precedent that's been established for a long time? And he actually offers a fascinating read of the text. He says, Rabbi Akiva says, if he eats a stewed vegetable and that's his food, meaning his idiosyncratic version of a meal, then in that case, the Chachamim reject the notion that because this person has an odd diet, they would say Birkat HaMazon according to different criteria from everyone else. But in a world in which the stewed vegetable has become a completely normal meal, and if anything, observant Jews who are constantly going out of their way to find a loaf of bread in order to be able to say a hamotzi on it and then not have to say the rest of the brachot in the meal and to wash their hands almost have a countercultural eating pattern. I don't think it's quite that strong, but nonetheless are sort of doing something very conscious in that way. That's already a different world, says Rav Bin Nun. And his argument is that the Chachamim in our world would concede to Rabbi Akiva's view. They were only objecting to an idiosyncratic standard, not to the notion that fundamentally you always bench, you always say Bir Karamazon after a meal. And he pulls out the verse in the Torah as kind of spiritual and homiletical support for this. He says, actually, the whole thing that that section of Sefer Dvarim is worried about is that people will eat, have their fill, and essentially pat themselves on the back for having been very successful in life. And one of the main things that Birkat HaMazon does is specifically at the moment of your greatest satiedness, you say, you know what? I couldn't have done this by myself. And I have tremendous gratitude and humility. And he therefore actually finds it outrageous that we would tolerate people not saying Birkat HaMazon after that kind of meal. Now, you probably want to know, so what do I do?
Always.
So this is one of these areas where I still struggle with this, where I'm basically 100% convinced that he's right, but I haven't been able to bring myself to actually do it yet. And I'm not even sure I fully understand what that is about. Some of it is, you know, saying blessings and invoking God's name is a serious thing. It's a big deal. You want to feel like it's really required. And if you have any doubt, the general principle is sfeik brachot lahakel, to deal kind of leniently in the sense of not saying a bracha when you're not sure if you should say it. But I think there's probably also something going on with the relationship between form and substance here, which is the form of bread is a very powerful and central one for Jews, even when certain cultural norms start to slip. And even without valorizing this, I think descriptively, it's probably true that, yeah, the fact that you have two loaves of bread on Friday night and bread is the way you like begin celebrations. And, you know, you give, you know, Uncle Shmuel gets the hamotzi at the bar mitzvah to kick off the celebration.
It's always my favorite moment at the bar mitzvah.
Right? I mean, there's something about that where it's hard to let go of that as being anything but just sort of a vestige of the past. Now, at the same time, I think Rav Binun is sort of right on the values front. And I'll just sort of, I don't know a better way than to kind of leave it there, that maybe we're just in a transitional position. And it could be that it'll be completely crystal clear to my grandchildren that, of course, they say Birkat HaMazon over any time they sit down, let's say, with a plate and silverware, as opposed to standing up, popping something in their mouth from the pantry. And if that turns out to be the case, I will not be upset.
So I have two follow-up questions on behalf of the gluten-free community. One is, do you think you would feel differently in practice if you were in a situation where you were never benching as opposed to never benching at lunch or sometimes? And the second question is, when you talk about the symbolic significance of bread, we now have this phenomenon of bread-like foods that are not actually motzi because they were made out of potato flour or some other, you know, gluten-free bread, basically. Does that feel like it should trigger motzi or benching in a different way because it has the symbolic feel of a gluten-free challah? It's challah. Or, you know, is this really something more about the actual product of the wheat, the flour?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we have one analog to the notion of something being one kind of food product but behaving like another and therefore doing an odd bracha switch, and that is rice. Rice is not a grain. And this sort of flips on the front end rather than the back end. Therefore, when you say the blessing kind of afterwards, you don't talk about chita and se'ora in the sense of wheat and barley and invoke the verse that talks about the things that grew in the land of Israel. You don't say the al hamichya, that long paragraph, which really is about those specific food items. But because it culturally ends up behaving like a grain, you say borei mine mizonot over it, right? You actually refer to it as the same kind of thing that wheat and barley are in the diet. And in a way, the proposal here would be, could you flip that and say that about Birkat HaMazon? Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say hamotzi lechem min haaretz, though truth be told, obviously the word lechem, bread, doesn't necessarily connote a specific grain that's going into it. But let's say you restricted that bracha for things that came from those products. You might nonetheless say, But this is functioning as bread culturally for the purposes of what Birkat HaMazon is dealing with. Right? The other analog to that is Pataba'a B'chisnin, which is something that's made of a mix of wheat and barley and something else, like, let's say, cornbread. And if you eat enough of that kind of stuff, you're actually supposed to do Birkat HaMazon, even though it's not a hamotzi necessarily when you first eat it. So that's some of the potential analogs here. I'll say this. I'm very sympathetic to someone who's gluten-free and in the situation where essentially, yeah, they're never going to say Birkat HaMazon, of saying they should follow Rav Yoel Ben-Nun's approach. Like, that makes a tremendous degree of sense. What I think you've now introduced, which is a really interesting thing, which I'd have to think about, is might you imagine a middle ground position for something like someone like that, where essentially they say, when I eat an imitation bread product, then I will say Birkat HaMazon. The rest of the time, I'll sort of conform to this form of the Jewish community and its practice of, yeah, I'm not going to, after having even a great big bowl of chana masala, say Birkat HaMazon. But when I do eat something that to the naked eye looks like bread, then I'll invoke Rav Yoel Ben-Nun's opinion. That might be a really interesting compromise.
Great, thanks.
He likes bread and butter, and he likes toast and jam. Oh, that's what his baby feeds him, and he's a loving man.
Well, I like bread and butter, I like toast and jam. That's what baby feeds me, I'm a loving man.
Responsa Radio is a project of the Center for Jewish Law and Values at Machon Hadar, and is produced by Open Quorum, which creates, curates, and promotes excellent Jewish content, and is funded in part by Next and Natan.